All right, well, thanks everybody for coming. I wanted to say a few words about the Writer in Residence or Journalist in Residence program, something that David Gross got started many years ago. And we use it really as a way to attract individuals who are doing science writing, either for journalism or, in Graham's case, for books. So one thing I wanted to say is if you know of someone that you think would benefit from coming here and really being, you know, embedding it at KXP, the goal of the program is to have writers really be here for, as Graham's here, for sort of a solid month so that they can really interact and learn new science topics. And Graham's going to talk about what the attraction is for him to be here. But please let me know if you know people. So we sort of advertise it. We get individuals, typically 2 to 3 per year. So Brandon Brown is coming in about a month from up in San Francisco. And he's going to be here for about a month. Sometimes we've had writers from Quantum magazine. Natalie Wolkover has been here. But you know, journalism, science journalism is, as all of you probably are aware, a dying breed. Even the Science Times and the New York Times is mostly now the Health Times, as far as I'm concerned. there's maybe one science article, but you know, that's important that it sells. So if you know of anybody, please let me know, okay? Or just encourage them to send me an email. It's a pretty informal process, but we really want to encourage that because we think it benefits both the science writer, but also benefits us to sometimes understand what the challenges are of science writing. And definitely for the journalists, they love to tell us what their challenges are, which is getting us to talk to them in a way they can understand. So first of all, I'm going to hand it over to Graham. Graham's been here 5 years ago, roughly. It was Graham's first visit. I was excited when he reached out to return. And so he's monitoring the evolution of the KXP as well.
thank you, Lars, and it's a real pleasure and a privilege to be here. And thank you, Lars, for enabling me to come to this wonderful place and to be among you in these two programs. Well, as Lars has so kindly said, I'm a member of a dying breed, and he's right, absolutely right, and I asked for it. I really, because I'm one of the people really cursed because I'm crazy enough to try to make a living by writing about theoretical physics. Now that is not, I think you'll agree, a good way to earn to earn a living. But I'm afraid I'm helpless because of my enjoyment as a subject, not so much as a practitioner, but as someone who appreciates it and wishes very much to persuade other people that this is a more than worthwhile activity, an essential activity for our culture. It particularly worrisome, as Lars has indicated, is the diminishing of coverage in science in newspapers, but also, of course, in books. And unless you happen to be Stephen Hawking and one or two other people, it's not an easy not easy these days to get actually noticed in books. And for those of us who measure our sales in Millie Hawkings, this is driven home to us each year. But we mustn't complain. Our job is to actually talk to people about the subject that's dear to us and persuade them that this is actually worthy of their support, intellectual and indeed perhaps through taxation. Now, what I want to do this afternoon, I'm just going to take 15 minutes of your time. I know you've got plenty of other things to do. I want to talk about the book I've just published, the book I'm now working on, and about two theoretical physicists that I have written about. And the reason for that, of course, is it's much easier to write about theoretical physicists rather than theoretical physics, because you have the leavening of character and incident. Let me begin with the book that I've just written, The Universe Speaks in Numbers, for which I began research here, and which I largely wrote at the Institute for Advanced Study, where I was delighted to be on the same corridor as Juan and his colleagues. That book is about, in our language, not public language, is about the interplay between mathematical ideas and theoretical physics, which is, as Einstein put it memorably in 1952, the quest to understand the deepest order in the universe that we see around us. Put simply, but it's good enough for Einstein, it's good enough for me. why did I want to write a book about that? Well, let me be honest, rather than give you the spiel, I still remember where I was, right, when I read a particular sentence of Dirac's, in my opinion, completely wonderful paper. Actually, it was a lecture, the Scott Lecture, which he gave in Edinburgh on the 6th of February 1939, called The Relation Between Physics and Mathematics. Now, in my judgment, right, if you had to write down the greatest 25 papers of Paul Dirac, that would count as one of them, right? Why? Because I think that is a masterpiece of popularization. It contains virtually no abstract variables at all, but it has phrase after phrase, observation after observation that has withstood the test of time. Michael Atiyah once told me during the course of writing this book that as a summary of what was to come ahead, it would be very difficult to better than to read that article. Starts in a classic way right at the beginning, where Dirac talks about how it is an empirical fact that the world around us has a mathematical quality that is by no means obvious to the casual observer. Right down there, right up to the application of quantum mechanics of relativity to the early universe. He does that in 1 hour. Right? And it's a remarkable essay. When I think about how I have to oversimplify, I think, well, if Dirac can do that, then it licenses lesser people like myself to attempt to do something vaguely similar. There's a sentence in that book that had long fascinated me. And again, it's one of these sentences I would give a disposable organ to have written. Right? Mathematics is a game that invented by mathematicians. Physics is a game in which, I misquoted slightly there, I'll get it right. Mathematics is a game in which the rules are invented by mathematicians. Physics is a game where the rules are given to us by nature. What is astonishing is that the rules that mathematicians find interesting are so similar to the ones that nature has chosen. Now, you look up that, it's pretty accurate rendition of what he said. That has long fascinated me, right? You could actually explain that to a janitor in some way, right? But I think it contains a very, very deep truth. I wanted to expose something that Einstein, Yang, and others have described as a miracle, this way that the physics and mathematics just join together so beautifully, something that you've all experienced, even I, in my humble way, have experienced in learning, the basic Maxwell theory and general relativity, and where you see these things come together so beautifully. And I confess as well that during the writing of the book, I became particularly disturbed, and I hope not in a pompous way, but in a way that was very real to me, of how the state of, if I may call it, our subject has now become one where people can take pot shots at it, saying that it has lost touch with reality, that people are lost in mathematics, they're doing fairy tale physics and what have you, and where that, in the way in which our culture has developed, that is seen, those kind of response to our subject, as having equal time with people who are genuine experts of the subject. And it disturbs me that not only that they are given equal time, but that people who are also scientists, people who are experts not in physics, they take this very seriously. I have to say I have good friends of mine, some of the most friends I share with one, who just dismiss this and say, nobody gives a rat's arse about this stuff, these people, they don't matter. I don't think that's true. I talk to a lot of people in my academic home in Cambridge, Royal Society in London, and you hear people saying this quite routinely now. Well, they're not doing real science, are they? I mean, why should we spend all this money on this subject? When I talked about my book at Cambridge at a soiree about 2 months ago, a former vice chancellor of Cambridge, very, very smart guy, said that in his view, the game was up for theoretical physicists, and we should be spending the research money on nuclear fusion. He meant it. And he's not a fool either. Somehow, although I think that argument is the argument that physicists are somehow collectively deluded at this juncture needs to have a response. So I wanted at least to draft my own response to that, and hope that other people will do it better and more effectively. And the way I chose to do that was to give it a historical perspective, to try to link the very beginnings of the subject, I know the date is to some extent arbitrary, with what you guys are doing now, to show that there is a contiguous series of events that show that what you are doing is in exactly the same spirit as the great people of the past. What I want to do now, just so that I'm not talking about myself the whole time, is I just want to give you a flyover of the some of the themes of The Universe Speaks in Numbers, partly to annoy you, because I should be saying some quite drastic things about the history of physics, some of which you may possibly not have heard before, but which I've picked up through conversations and reading on the history of the subject from what I call real experts. I would say the wise thing to do is to go back to what I consider a red letter day in the history of civilization since Homo sapiens got up on its hind legs. The 6th of July, 1687. That is a completely unremarkable day in torrid London. But that was a day in which a book went on sale in London, and it was called The Principia. And it was written by a little known person, little known outside Cambridge, by the name of Isaac Newton. And what he did, in the words of Einstein, good enough for me, is set up the first working system of what we now call theoretical physics. You know what he did, but very briefly, he set laws of motion, he had a unified theory of gravity that worked not just on Earth, but it extended throughout the cosmos, and he did a series of calculations using geometry, not calculus, incidentally, he did not use that there, although he'd invented it several years before and used it later. He demonstrated that you could use it to implement a philosophy that we all now take as completely passé, so to speak. Namely, that the purpose of understanding the physical natural world, right, is to set out mathematical laws in mathematically precise language, which gives this branch of science its generality and its specificity, and that you compare the predictions of that with the most accurate experiments. And if they don't work, you go back and change the theory. Now, you're probably thinking, well, why is he making such a big deal of that? That was certainly not something that was in the majority when he wrote that book. In fact, as a great my favourite historian, Simon Schaffer, stressed to me, brilliantly in my view, even the title of that book would have been a shock to people. The Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy. This is ridiculous. Why would they have mathematical principles? It really was a book that shook the way we look at nature. It didn't even sell out, or it barely sold out, right? In its first few years. But as you know, we're still living. You could argue, if you were being really provocative, that we're writing footnotes to that agenda today. And I want to stress that although two things. First of all, Newton was not a physicist. He was a natural philosopher. I recommend the great book written by Rob Iliffe, my friend at the University of Oxford, called Priest of Nature. Dirac regarded himself above all, way above all, as a man of God. He was trying to understand God's creation, a perfect creation, which he believed that he and people comparably smart to him could understand in terms of mathematics. And the other thing was that he saw experiment as the thing you aspire to. You must always refer constantly to experiment. And that's why I think I edited out of the final cut of the book. But he was the first person to set up a global gravity project. He was fanatical, right, in this man's prodigious industry in checking the inverse square law of gravity by looking at the tides and pendula and what have you all over the world, right? Liaising with research teams all over from South America right the way up to Vietnam and Indonesia. His commitment to experiment was just as strong as it was to mathematics. And I argue in the book that only someone of Newton's, I don't want to use the word genius, but his preeminent brilliance, if you like, right, could have did what he did. A great experimenter, a great theoretician, and a great mathematician. It took that to build on the legacy of your Keplers, your Descartes, your Galileos, all of whom made significant contributions, and I don't try to disentangle them because that's the work of historical scholars. All serious scholars agree that Newton was the person that pulled it all together and set out the agenda we now work on. Now, it's important that we don't idolize Newton too much in the sense that he did not complete that program for gravity. He made calculational errors. He died not understanding the tides. He died not understanding the orbits of Jupiter. There were other things he did. Now, he knew he'd achieved something great. Of course he did, and he was completely right. But that program, the Newtonian program, was completed on the continent by Pierre Simon Laplace, known as the French Newton, especially in France, and his colleagues, your D'Alemberts, your Clairauts, and what have you. They developed advanced mathematics, and they built on Newton's edifice, and they completed this amazing program that showed that our cosmos is indeed governed by this very simple mathematical law. Now, again, I told you I'm flying high over this territory here. By the 1800s, we start to see, Newton has been long dead, right? We start to see physics as we now understand it taking shape. And it took shape in one country, right? No, not Britain, France. It was in the early 1800s that the modern discipline of physics, as it's practiced and taught in schools, optics, hydraulics, you know, acoustics and what have you, the textbooks started coming out on recognisably physics books. In particular, one written in 1815 by a Laplace student, Biot. There were plenty of others as well. That is where physics took shape. And the person who I identify, and it's not just me, of course, I'm basing it on a lot of very fine work done by scholars, is Laplace, who was the leader of this subject, who was a superb applied mathematician, cared deeply about the world, and he set up what, in the provocative language of another of my favourite historians, John Heilbrun, called the first true standard model. Right? That standard model was the way he talked about the little subparticles at the smallest part of nature being attracted to each other by these central forces from which you could derive, he thought, everything if you worked hard enough. Now, that simple model, right, Laplace believed would explain everything. And lest you think this was a small thing, that was the first true school of mathematical physics in a French suburb south of Paris. People came from all over the Western world to talk to Laplace about the way that it was seen as that's the way forward. Now, we now laugh at this idea, the idea of these particles being held together by these central forces and impermeable solids and all the rest of it. But that's where the subject took shape. And a shout out for Napoleon, because he was a very big factor in this, particularly in his sponsorship, not just of Laplace, and they were very close. He even appointed him as a minister, albeit for, I think, about 15 days or something like that. But he was a close friend of Laplace and those colleagues and did a huge amount to stimulate our understanding of electricity. So we have physics established by the early 1800s. Now, theoretical physics, you're all, I guess, theoretical physicists. You're working in a very young field. Very young field. I mean, compared with medicine, you're looking at astronomy and subjects like that. Theoretical physics is just started yesterday. The consensus is that theoretical physics as an autonomous discipline began around 1870. Now, it flourished particularly not in Britain, but in Germany. That's where many of the world's leading theoretical physicists, as we now would call them retrospectively, that's where they cut their teeth. But before I get on to just describe that that period in culture where theoretical physics really took root, I want to describe someone who many of you will probably think of as a truly great theoretical physicist, but if you spoke to him now, he would deny it. That name is James Clerk Maxwell. One of the highlights of writing this book was to discover the almost blameless character of Maxwell and his astonishing farsightedness. You all know that he was the person who pioneered our classical theory of electromagnetism. And he did that by building on the work of his hero, that's his work, not mine, Michael Faraday. And he credited Michael Faraday as being an exceptionally gifted mathematician, although it is often said that the most advanced mathematics that Faraday did was balancing the books of the Royal Institution. But he did come up with the idea of the field, right? And I remember taking out my friend Nima Arkani Hamed to the Royal Institution and showing the pages on which he was first setting out the idea of the field, and Nima's arms going goosebumps, right? It was quite a thing to actually. Well, I've actually got a photograph of it, where you see the field actually taking place in the mind of this non-mathematical person, and then it was given to this powerful mathematician Maxwell, who clothed it in the language that you all use now. We all use.
And my understanding is not only did Faraday conceive of a field, but he also conceived of what we think of as Maxwell's equations, as rates of change of flux, and he defined quantities associated with the field and quantified, but without equations.
Yeah. There's a lot of truth in that, and I'm not being facetious when I say that. It is astonishing to read. Let's just say something that frames that, right? That when Maxwell decided to roll up his sleeves and, his words, attack electricity within 2 weeks of finishing his undergraduate work. Right? And the first thing he did on the advice of Lord Kelvin was to read the collected works of Michael Faraday. And if you go and look at Maxwell's stuff, you see him literally just interpreting mathematically the results that Faraday was getting in his laboratory in the Royal Institution. It's quite astonishing to see him do it, right? Leading him to these phrases he introduced, div, grad, curl, and what have you. So you see two master intuitionists, one with no mathematics, one with lots of it, maybe not to the extent of a Newton, but still a very, very good mathematician. Now, one thing to say, because I didn't phrase it very well. Maxwell never described himself. That's a strong phrase. He never described himself as a theoretical physicist. He was a natural philosopher. His main reading was the Bible. His second major reading was Shakespeare. Reading them on his deathbed, which is a little bit later. He saw himself as somebody who was trying to understand the order given to us in God's creation. Remember, his last appointment was to become the Cavendish Professor of Experimental Physics. So he was also somebody of very, very broad interests and deeply lovable. And I don't use that word about physicists very lightly, but I mean, he really was. I mean, he was much loved by many people for his generosity of spirit. And that philosophy thing is not to be taken lightly. We know from people that knew him that in his later years, when we didn't know he was dying, he would be very happy chatting in the Trinity College common room with students about philosophy. He was quite happy to do that. Today, that could be seen as a dirty word. For Maxwell, it certainly was not. Now, many of Maxwell's favourite thinkers in that field were in Germany. Helmholtz in particular, there were Clausius, and he knew these people were absolutely first rate. And it was this part of Europe where theoretical physics, in the modern sense of the word, really took root. Now, what do I mean by theoretical physics taking root? I define a theoretical physicist, if you'll forgive me the lack of specificity here, as somebody who does none or almost no experiments, probably because they can't do them, but they do very, very little, if any, and they spend their entire time researching and teaching that subject. Now, if you use that criterion, the first theoretical physicist was Max Planck. You could have a friendly argument and you could say it was Clausius, right? But Clausius ran a laboratory. right? There is Kirchhoff and there's other people that vied for that. But we did see in the 1870s this tendency for people to be focusing on just thinking their way into nature. And Simon Schaffer said something to me which I've never forgotten. This is the first time in history when society got together and said, we will pay people to do what you guys do. Right? Not actually be productive, right? But actually just to think your way into nature. And I say again, right? That was only 150 years ago. It's really nothing. It's a few generations. Your great-great-great-grandparents. Not that long ago. Max Planck, you'll know, is honoured by us as a great theoretical physicist. He was a very conservative, with a small c, person. And you'll know about the work that made him so famous when he discovered by barbaric mathematics and extremely strong experimental reasoning the idea of the energy quantum. But I want to go back and just pay another respect to the great Maxwell. He wrote in his high-kicking articles about the future of natural philosophy that he thought there were things we just didn't understand, the idea of every atom having the same spectra or what have you. He said the branches of natural philosophy in the future, we probably haven't got them, even got their names yet. It's a phrase I've heard here somewhere, people thinking they're groping towards something and there's something over the hill, so to speak. Now, if you look at that, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, what he means. He's talking about quantum mechanics and he's talking about relativity. Quantum mechanics was named by Max Born, relativity by Max Planck. Not a very good name, actually. Einstein used to call it invariance theory, right? But those are the things that Maxwell was so close to doing when he died in 1879, right? But they were brought to fruition by the scientists that you're very familiar with.
I ask a question, what about somebody like Boltzmann or Lorentz?
Boltzmann definitely would have been a runner-up to Planck as being one of the first.
How about Lorentz?
Lorentz was also a third runner-up. Yeah.
In whose race?
Oh, well, what I'm saying is, when you're writing a book, like as I was doing, you want to know who would be the first person to qualify there, right? And the consensus was among historians that it would be Max Planck would be identified as the first theoretical physicist, right? But I did say there are other people who you could bring in if you wanted to make their case, Helmholtz, and you're quite right, Lorentz was another. But a remarkable number came from Germany. Right, where after the Franco-Prussian War and Bismarck's creation of the unified Germany, there was an enormous rush of resource into those universities, and the spin-off of theoretical physics came out of that in the 1870s. It really, of course, it gave us in the second generation Albert Einstein, of course, is the poster child of the subject, Time magazine's Person of the Year, and has given us, if you like, an emblematic figure in culture, and in most people, I think, recognize him as someone as a major figure, and we're blessed, I think, in some ways to have him because he's from our field, right, and someone who has a wide popular appeal. In my book, I want to stress the thing that comes out of Dirac's lecture very clearly, which is that both relativity and quantum mechanics took physicists into mathematics that they previously regarded as too abstract, that they needn't bother with. The most dramatic example, you've probably heard of it, and it's still an amazing story, which I spend three or four pages on it, is Einstein going from believing that modern mathematics was, in his words, a pure luxury, to something he needed in full in order to realize his general theory of relativity, the generalization of his special theory to gravity. And in quantum mechanics, you have non-commutation, you have the geometric introduction of geometry to quantum mechanics in Dirac's theory of the monopole, and so on. So you see mathematics and physics coming together in those subjects in their early formation. The second half of the book is mainly about you could regard it as a story of how any fundamental theory has got to involve a jamming together of these things which, as Einstein and others said, looked completely irreconcilable: quantum mechanics and relativity. the subject we see talked about here all the time. You go back and look at Einstein, and you will see him saying there, I doubt whether these things will ever be reconcilable. And indeed, even Dirac had his moments of doubt on this when he was one of the pioneers of relativistic quantum field theory. But as I say, and you know far better than I do, in bringing those together, we've got a quantum field theory of all the atomic interactions, and the goal now, of course, is to bring all of those subjects, all of the fundamental forces within a unified framework. And I attempt to argue that that if you want that unifying framework between the atomic forces, so to speak, and gravity, you are forced into what you're doing, which is a subject which at the moment is very, very difficult to test experimentally, which is not to say one shouldn't try, of course.
I want to turn this into a conversation in the next few minutes.
Yeah, sure. I've only got one last thing down at the bottom here. Okay. I've stressed to you that that project came out of my biography of Dirac. Just a couple of things here, that Martin Rees, good friend of mine, person of great wisdom, I still got the email where he begged me not to write the book because Dirac was so boring. That's true. It is true. I've got the email. And the American publisher who admonished the editor for buying the book off, saying, who on earth will be interested in such a boring man, such a boring subject that no one's interested in? I was very pleased that it was possible to move outside the endless biographies of Feynman and Einstein, great figures without question, that to extend the popular palette. What I'm now doing is I'm going back, as I speak, to writing the authorized biography of Stephen Hawking, who, of course, did argue his greatest work was when you're bringing together a quantum mechanics and relativity in black holes, something that you're still talking about today. I'm very interested in not just the work you're doing, but hearing about anything you have to say about not just what I've spoken about, but about Stephen Hawking himself, about his work. Maybe you think his work was underrated or overrated. Right? I'm trying to get a view of the of what the community actually think of him and his contribution to physics. And in 5 years' time, I hope I maybe come back and give you a talk on that particular book. Meanwhile, I just wanted to say thank you for listening to this. Please come up and speak to me. I'm ready to talk about anything apart from Brexit. Harry and Meghan as well.
Graham, I have a question.
Sure.
About science communication.
Sure.
As I'm sure you know very well, there are lots of channels of communication that are, I guess, in use today. Mm. Twitter, blogs, public lectures on the internet, Netflix, and what is effective, these channels are noisy, as you know, as well.
It is true. I did say at the beginning, and I'm not really joking. I don't want to feel. Look, we shouldn't feel sorry for ourselves. If someone like me elects to spend their life writing, you shouldn't feel sorry for yourself. You don't have to do it, right? But it is true that it's much harder now to get, which is why you have so many biographies of Einstein, so many things about Feynman. You can get those things commissioned. In order to get noticed, it has to be something that the increasingly competitive media believe will have some purchase with the public. And the subject, this is tremendously broad brush, so forgive me, but now you can see with the state of theoretical physics, you look at these wonderful lectures we have here, right? You don't see dramatic, you know, look at this, what happens when you compare this theoretical prediction with that, or this discovery of this new particle. We've had our Higgs, we've had our gravitational waves, but the pace is much slower, right? So the subject lends itself, I would say now, right, to a more, if you take people who are very critical of the subject, right, and go completely against the author, and they will get noticed, right? And I personally regret that. I don't believe in muffling speech, but I wish the community were more articulate, because I feel that the public support for this grand enterprise, and I think it is a grand enterprise, is in danger of being suffocated. Maybe that seems too overstatement, but I'm concerned about it.
Actually, maybe you could amplify on, you wish the community could be more articulate. What do you
I'm saying, for example, let's not talk. You know, we saw an article in New York Times, was it last February, about how we should just put all collider budgets on hold because there was no reason to do do you remember that article? Right. What was the response? I think Lisa Randall wrote, which, to her credit, and there was one other, Jeffrey Bernstein wrote. But much to my dismay, there was no, how can I put it, thunderous response. You don't have to be rude to the person that writes it. You play the ball, not the player. But I thought the response was feeble, frankly. Right? I know a lot of people who read that article, yes. Right? And a lot of people take it seriously. Now, I know that, actually, I've got people who I think are great physicists who just say, just forget it, it'll go away. I'm not so sure it's as simple as that. Remember, this is the country that lost the Super Collider, right? And I remember Steve Weinberg telling me he really didn't think the US government would do that. Well, they did.
So that was spun out of the op-ed pages of the New York Times?
It was last February, I remember.
But is that the channel that...
Well, that was very effective. I'll tell you one thing, on Twitter, which is a thing I'm about to leave because I think it's such a fetid part of our culture. although that's how people like me, a non-entity essentially, that's how you can get out there,
yes.
Right? But if you go out there saying, theoretical physicists are doing great stuff, they're not actually finding anything at the moment, but give us 50 years and we'll find something. That's not a very appealing thing to a New York op-ed writer. Right, it's much more noticeable when you say, "Well, these physicists don't know what they're talking about." Right, and I said this to me is very unfortunate, actually, and that's why I think somehow physicists have got to these are quiet times, to use Weinberg's phrase, right? And somehow physicists have got to make the case that it's worth persevering. Right, how you do it is not easy, and it's not obvious to me how you do it most effectively. I've done my bit in my book. I'm sure there's more effective ways of doing it.
If I could just give a counter argument.
Sure,
to that.
Please.
We observed gravitational waves,
sure,
for the first time a few years ago.
Yeah, wonderful.
100 years after Einstein predicted.
Indeed.
I think that's a beautiful example.
Yeah.
And people have made, you know, this argument to the public.
Yeah.
Look, this is, you know, theoretical physics, fundamental insight into the universe. Mm-hmm. Take time to, you know, see observationally.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have the Event Horizon Telescope, another very...
That was a wonderful thing, yes.
First picture of a black hole.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe not really a black hole.
I know. Yeah.
But it catches the public's eye.
It does.
So, in now, the past few years...
No question.
I mean, attendance in my graduate general relativity class has skyrocketed.
Yeah.
Everybody wants to learn about general relativity all of a sudden.
Yeah.
I think it partly comes...
No, I agree. I don't question that at all. You're manifestly right. I'm simply saying that across the subject as a whole, particularly in the area of understanding the atom, it's been I remember when I was a member of the group that was actually looking for the promotion of the Large Hadron Collider within the UK community. And I was looking at that when you look back at what physicists were telling us they were hoping for, and you look at what they found now, it's... You know, you literally go, oh my God, you know, all these extra dimensions, axions, you know, all these things, supersymmetry coming out of every detector's eyeballs practically, you know, and then we see, it's a wonderful achievement. I'm not denying that, because we know what the extent of that achievement was. But for the public, it's, well, that was 50 years ago, they've discovered, okay, what's new, you know? I'd say we've got to realise we live in a competitive world now, and there are other calls that people say, well, why shouldn't, like the former Vice Chancellor of Cambridge, say, why don't we spend this money on new types of energy? We need to answer that question, and the money is not pouring out of people's wallets anymore. So, but I don't disagree with your art. Those are wonderful things, especially for me, because I dare say you look roughly the same vintage as me. I remember people saying they'll never be discovered, these things. I remember Ron Drever, when I invited him to give a talk at the Open University, and people were laughing at him. I remember it very clearly. So it was a wonderful thing to see that. Yeah?
Just to follow up a little bit on this, I mean, there's the flip side of it, in terms of overhyping the subject.
Yes.
And I was wondering, what is your sort of historical perspective on the sort of the dangers of that?
Of overhyping, sorry.
The subject, how, you know, what all we will learn, how exciting it is from the...
Yeah. Well, this is difficult. I have to say, one of my weaknesses as a writer, and I'm not just saying this, is I know that people like you will read or might because they're reading my books and say, that's hype, right? So I try not to. But the fact is, we're living in what Nabokov brilliantly called, in my view, the moronic inferno, right? where everything is hyped, right? What Donald Trump has for breakfast is hyped, you know? So, but you know, the way in which we're trained, our culture is to be measured, cautious, conservative, small c, right? That is in conflict with. Right. Now,
you're not saying history. I mean, you're saying history would not punish us for hyping things up more than we are.
Well, sometimes we do. I would say, for example, that the launch of CERN, if you remember, that I thought was an example. When everything went wrong, do you remember at the very beginning of the thing? That was an example, I think. But normally, I think physicists are terribly cautious about these things. And as I said, temperamentally, I find it very difficult to do. But when you see people who are good at talking up those things, you know, then they will catch the reader's eye. I mean, I admired, for example, Sean Carroll's book, which I haven't actually read, I don't even say that, but you see that he's reaped the rewards of being out in the media all the time. Now, you may not agree with his views on the centrality of the of interpretations of quantum mechanics, but you, to his credit, he's out there. You know, he has actually got their attention. In the UK, Brian Cox, right? You see him, it may not be the greatest experimental physicist in history, but my goodness, he's made an impression on the general public. And it's a gift for people to do that, and it's one I don't think we should be embarrassed about. I've taken too much of your time, but last.
So, Graham, what would you view as a success of your visit here?
Let me name three things. First of all, people telling me of their views on Stephen Hawking in a way that will help me get an informed view. A few golden anecdotes that you don't want made public, right? Sorry, that's the cheap part of my thing. But also, incidentally, for me to hear about the state of your of the programs here, it's a real pleasure to be able to be part of these discussions. And then I hope live long enough to see how history gradually washes over this, and we get something that is even more beautiful than the understanding we have now.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.